The rest of today's service will be conducted by Reverend Tracy Springberry.
So our reading this morning is from Jeffrey Lockwood. It's called A Mother's Songs. Once upon a time, a thief snuck into a room of a sleeping Buddhist monk. As the burglar rummaged about, the monk awoke. The startled thief ran into the snowy streets with the monk racing after him. "Please stop," the monk called, and the man finally did. Realizing that his partner was no threat, "You'll need this," the monk gasped, handing the thief his coat. "What do you mean?" the man asked. "I saw that you dashed from my room into the cold without as much as a winter wrap, and I realized that I had a woolen blanket and a coat." Having heard this impossible tale of sainthood years ago, I forgot the details, but remembered the essential events. Ordinary people can't be morally compelled to make such extraordinary sacrifices. But for whatever reason, perhaps the sheer absurdity of such an unconditional altruism, this parable stuck with me. It rattled around in my skeptical mind until the day my wife played the role of the Buddhist monk. Nan and I were headed to the mountains for a day of skiing with our children, who were 4 and 6 at the time. In the chaos of packing that morning, we'd forgotten our daughter's mittens. The wind was whipping and mercury hovered in the teens, so the mittens, no mittens meant no skiing. But for Nan, the solution was as obvious as it was simple. She always wore 2 pairs of socks, so she removed the outer layer and pulled them over Aaron's hands. The problem was solved, and we headed to the trail. I found her approach rather clever, a sort of practical, motherly thinking that often eludes my own analytical mind, but hardly heroic. However, the bitter cold and the woolen warmth evoked the parable of the monk's coat. Among the snow-hushed pines, I remembered how the dialogue ended. "I don't understand," said the man. "It is simple. You have nothing at all to keep you warm," the monk answered. "But you are a fool to give away your coat, leaving you with only a blanket," the man replied, reaching for the coat. "If I had 2 gloves on one hand and none on the other, would I be a fool to not put one of them on my bare hand?" the monk asked. The man said nothing, took the coat, and hurried down the street. When we are not alienated, when love draws us into the suffering of others, when we see our happiness entwined with their well-being, then generosity is neither foolish nor heroic. It is the simplest and most obvious choice. When I left Portland early one morning last week for Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, a perfect line of vibrant pink traced the edges of the darkened Mount Hood and its foothills. The sky was midnight blue, and the orange pulsed faintly behind the pink-lined mountains. Cars, thick as swarming ants, surged onto the freeways. Then I was swept away from the rising sun and the city and into the trees. The Columbia River, large and quiet, held close to the road, like a companion. And I felt utterly alive, utterly of this world, and grateful for this planet that made my life possible. I was on holy ground. Friedrich Schleiermacher, the 19th century theologian, said this feeling, the feeling of being utterly dependent upon an inextricable part of life itself, was the grounding of all religions. According to Schleiermacher, religions with their rituals, creeds, liturgies and theologies try to make meaning of these awe-inspiring moments when we feel utterly dependent upon and part of life itself. When we see photos of the earth from space, when we are surrounded by wilderness, when we watch a baby come swelling into the world, when we hold the hand of a dying person. From these fundamental experiences springs the central teaching of so many faiths. Love your neighbor as yourself. Be compassionate. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Be generous. It is the realization of this author in this morning's reading. When we are not alienated, he says, when love draws us into the suffering of others, when we see our happiness intertwined in their well-being, then generosity is neither foolish nor heroic. It is the simplest, most obvious choice. When we are alienated, when we do not notice the suffering of others, when we cannot see our way, the way our happiness is intertwined with theirs, the web has been torn and it no longer holds. Well, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, I attended and presented at the Kootenai County Human Rights Task Force Conference, Returning Civility to America's Democracy, the Promotion of Civil Dialogue. I had been deeply concerned last spring that Trump's hateful speech would unleash an avalanche of hateful expression into the public sphere. I felt strongly that people needed to begin working together for civil conversations across difference to combat hate. So a couple of members of the Coeur d'Alene congregation and I met with Cody Stewart, who is one of the people who helped remove the Aryan Nations who were in northern Idaho for a number of years, and they helped remove them through a lot of work out of northern Idaho and shut them down. And that was about 16 years ago. And Tony was also a really important human rights activist in Coeur d'Alene in North Idaho. So we went to him and to discuss this issue of civility in dialogue and what could we be doing in Coeur d'Alene to promote that. So he had been mulling over the same question, fortunately, and our interest was enough for him to commit to having a conference where elected officials, media people, and religious leaders all spoke on civility in the public discourse. And I was not wrong last spring when I was at the modeling of ugly, mean, racist, misogynist speech at presidential debates, rallies, tweets, and sound bites would empower some people to behave in similar ways. We hear more reports of people, including children, spewing racist and other hateful speech. The New York Times last week related the story of Veronica Zuleta, a Latina woman and U.S. citizen, who was shopping at a high-end grocery store in Menlo Park, California. The man next to her said, "You should go to Safeway. This store's for white people." Zuleta was shocked. No one had ever spoken to her that way before. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines incivility as a rude or discourteous act. Other definitions include bullying and other disrespectful words and actions. Incivility had been increasing well before the 2016 election campaign. KRC Research did an annual poll on civility from 2010 to 2014 and reported that 95% of Americans believe our interactions at work, in public, at school, and online are increasingly uncivil. 50% of Americans have ended a friendship, 24% have left jobs, and 19% have switched their children to new schools because of repeated rudeness and bullying. Most people expect to experience rude behavior each and every day from someone. At the conference, the keynote speaker, Cornell W. Clayton, the director of the Thomas S. Foley Institute for Public Policy and Public Service at Washington State University, gave some reasons why incivility has increased, at least in politics. Over the last 40 years, Americans have become increasingly polarized by political party. He showed a scale that described favorability ratings, and 100 is absolutely love, and 0 is absolutely despised. During Carter's presidency, most people had a 50 favorability rating towards the other party. However, today, people have a 75 favorability rating towards people in their own party, and an 18 rating of people in the other party. Considering that cockroaches have a favorability rating of 25, Americans really dislike people who are in the other party. In fact, a quarter of Democrats and a third of Republicans believe the other party is a threat to the nation's well-being. Meanwhile, people identify more strongly with their party than they have in decades. Today, party affiliation says something about who you are. Additionally, Americans more than in the past take on faith what their party promotes as good, without engaging critical thinking about policy decisions. The Affordable Care Act is an excellent example. The Conservative Heritage Foundation created the model for the Affordable Care Act. Republicans first proposed the idea. Obama and Democrats really wanted a single-payer system. However, single-payer was dead on arrival, and Obama used the Republicans' model as a way to pass health care reform at all. At the moment Obama and the Democrats began promoting the Affordable Care Act model, Republicans dropped it like a hot potato. This was not about the policy, which they had previously liked, but a decision based totally on party identification. Once Democrats took up the health care model, Republicans had to hate it. Meanwhile, Democrats, who really wanted single-payer, began to embrace the Affordable Care Act model, often because Obama and the Democrats were promoting it, even though it was far from anything most Democrats had wanted before. In American politics today, this often happens as people polarize around prioritize party affiliation over critical thinking. At the same time, Americans have been segregating themselves by lifestyle and prefer to associate with people who have their values and their perspectives. Towns, neighborhoods, schools, activities, and churches have become associated with certain identities. People often do not know those with radically different political and religious views. To make matters worse, Americans are nearly equally divided between Republicans and Democrats, making it very difficult for either party to elect a majority and get anything done. This is happening at a time when the stakes could not be higher. At issue is world economic transformation, economic inequality, climate change, and immigration. So it really matters to us what happens next in the economic and political arena. Our livelihoods and our basic values are all on the line. What we don't know, we don't like, and we don't trust the other side, and are exceedingly anxious about our own livelihood and the world situation, well, that's when it's really easy to get mean. When we are afraid, it's easy to dismiss, put down, and hurt those you believe will dismiss, put down, and hurt you, or the values you hold most dear. And it has happened. Language and actions have become violent and dangerous. People are being hurt, economically, emotionally, and physically. Fear is rising. People of color are afraid for themselves and their children. White progressives are afraid of a virulent racism and woman-hating sentiment they had not fully appreciated existed. Trump supporters are afraid of people of color, of mainstream politicians, of banks and other institutions that they blame for a lower quality of life. This is where we are politically. We are alienated from each other. We know little of each other's suffering. We no longer see the way our happiness is intertwined with others. The web is torn and ripped. So how do we fix it? At the Congress, at the conference, secular leaders and religious leaders who range theologically from me to the leader of the evangelical megachurch in town, all repeated the same message. We must love. We must be compassionate. We must listen. We must love. We must be compassionate. We must listen. And that just sounds like great advice, doesn't it? But how are you really supposed to be compassionate and listen to people who appear in the news and sometimes in real life to be unhitched from reality, unable to think logically or read facts, use horrific language to describe people different than themselves, and hold views and ideas we find absolutely repugnant? What seems better than listening and being compassionate is to win elections. And if we are politically liberal, hope that improved economic conditions will improve their lives so they will change. These are the moments when emotional and spiritual intelligence are required. Emotional intelligence is the ability to name and manage our own emotions, to have empathy with others, and to have productive relationships. When we listen to others, especially if we do not agree with them, we need to know when certain comments and attitudes will trigger our strong emotions and then know how to manage those triggered emotions. We need to be able to listen in such a way that we can experience empathy for another person, even if their experience and their interpretation of their experience is so very different than our own, and we absolutely do not agree with them. Spiritual intelligence is not as uniformly defined as emotional intelligence. The definitions that speak to me focus on the set of skills that make a person a spiritual leader. These would be the traits shared by the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, and similar people, and include being loving, kind, forgiving, peaceful, courageous, honest, generous, persistent, faithful, wise, and inspiring. Cindy Wigginsworth, author of SQ21, The 21 Skills of Spiritual Intelligence, defines this type of spiritual intelligence as the ability to act with wisdom and compassion while maintaining inner and outer peace, regardless of the circumstances. Spiritual for Wigginsworth means an innate human need to be in relationship with something larger than ourselves, something we consider to be divine or sacred or of great nobility. Wigginsworth does not use the word spiritual to mean a particular set of beliefs or a belief in supernatural realm. Instead, it refers to the very real human need to be in relationship with something larger than ourselves, whether we call that God or humanity or nature or family. It is not unlike Schleiermacher's feeling of being utterly dependent upon and an inextricable part of life itself. When we are spiritually intelligent, we act from our relationship with whatever we consider to be larger than ourselves. The spiritually intelligent also act out of the understanding that we are interconnected. It is this monk in this morning's reading who gave his coat to the robber because for the monk, keeping the robber warm was the same as keeping himself warm. Spiritual intelligence includes, for example, knowing your worldview and that it differs from other people's worldviews. Knowing your mission and values and being able to live those out. Operating out of one's higher self and not out of one's personal ego needs. Focusing on spiritual practice and personal growth. The word intelligence in emotional and spiritual intelligence does not mean something a person is born with, but it is a set of skills that exist that we can all develop. We can all become emotionally and spiritually intelligent. Emotionally and spiritually intelligent people help reweave the tattered web of life. One way to practice emotional and spiritual intelligence is to listen to someone with compassion. Listening deeply can tie two estranged strands of the web back together. Listening fully without judgment changes us. It also changes the person that we listen to. It creates relationships and shared empathy where none existed before. As we listen, we discover new ways of being human. As we listen, we learn our blind spots and our prejudices. We discover those others that we may have objectified and dismissed are human beings with their own struggles and their own pain. Listening with empathy changes us, not just psychologically, but physically. When we are compassionate towards someone else, our body actually releases oxytocin, called the love drug,
The oxytocin actually makes us more trustworthy, more generous, more charitable, and more compassionate, thus creating the conditions that are necessary to build all those skills that make us more emotionally and spiritually intelligent. One of the best stories that I have heard about the transformation through relationships is from the online magazine, The Greater Good. Claiborne Paul Ellis was born into a poor white family in 1927 in the South. He was taught, and he believed, that African Americans caused his poverty. He joined the Ku Klux Klan, as his father had, and was at the top position of the local KKK branch. Then, in 1971, he was invited to a 10-day community meeting to tackle racial tensions in the schools. He was chosen to lead the steering committee with Ann Atwater, a black activist he absolutely despised. It was the relationship with Ann that changed Ellis. By sharing stories, he learned that she had suffered the pain of poverty just as he had. Somehow, he didn't know. He said, "I was beginning to look at a black person, shake hands with him, and see him as a human being." He recalled, "It was almost like being born again." On the final night of the meeting, he stood in front of 1,000 people and tore up his Klan membership card. Ellis later became a labor organizer for a union whose membership was 70% African American. He and Ann remained friends for the rest of their lives. There are many stories like this, relationships that transform. There are stories of Palestinian and Israeli parents who lost children in the conflict and reached out to each other to work for peace. There's the stories of Americans who suddenly realized that they had friends and family members who were gay, and thus began to support same-sex marriage. These relationships repair a piece of the web and make new repairs possible. In forms of community organizing that connect a diversity of organizations, such as unions, schools, churches, nonprofits, the organizational building blocks are relational meetings. Often people do not share political or religious perspectives across these organizations, but they care about the same thing, like healthcare reform or sick leave and issues such as that. In this meeting, two people share their stories of their lives and what is important to them. These meetings build a web of relationships strong enough to hold the organizations and members together enough to make community changes. So my challenge to each of us is to reach out and find people who are different than we are, people who have different faiths, people from different political backgrounds, people with different lived experience economically or educationally, and have relational meetings and get to know each other. The point is not to argue or try to convince anybody of anything. Just share your lives. What is important? What scares you? What brings you joy? And why do you believe what you believe? These conversations are a chance to practice the skills of emotional and spiritual intelligence. It is an opportunity to set aside your own perspective and any righteousness you might hold about these views and become genuinely curious about the other person and how he or she understands life. It is a chance to challenge your own prejudices and find commonalities. It is an occasion to practice compassion. I have personally been very curious why any woman would vote for Donald Trump. I couldn't actually ask any of those women because I didn't know any. And I didn't have any time to find anyone to ask. I still haven't had time. But I got really lucky because soon after those tapes were released, I was listening to NPR, and they interviewed a woman who worked on the Trump campaign on the issue of abortion. She was a long, long-time anti-abortion activist. She was struggling because she found the tapes horrifying and could find no way to excuse Trump. she actually kept saying, well, Hillary's done bad things, but not this bad. She was really struggling. However, after much soul-searching, she had decided that she would still vote for him. She was clear that it was not because she respected him, but because she strongly believed in the anti-abortion cause and was so worried about the Supreme Court vacancies. To support her values, ones that she had committed her life to, she needed to vote for Trump. And there was no question that it was a difficult decision. After hearing her, I found I could really respect her decision. Not because I agreed with her, but because I knew she struggled to make a decision out of her deepest values. She tried to be faithful to who she truly was. And in that moment, I felt the web repair just a little bit. I was not inclined to rant because her values and decisions were so different than my values and the decisions I would make. Instead, I felt compassion, and I really wondered how I would handle a presidential election with a candidate I could not respect. But when the Supreme Court justices were on the line, and I simply didn't know what I would actually do. I considered much how people can have very different values and how difficult it is to manage life when this is true. It is the struggle of American democracy. It is the struggle of any democracy. Mount Hood was not etched in pink before me, and the Columbia did not flow by my side. But as the respect in me for this woman grew in me, I felt that I was standing on holy ground. May it be so.
Thank you, Tracy. We have 12 minutes for questions and comments. Thanks. So in your list of ills, to listen and to love, in our hyper-competitive and society in a competitive world, I would actually add that we have to be willing to lose. And what I mean by that is we have to be willing not to live in the best neighborhood or go to the best school or be the smartest person in the room or be the leader or be the most enlightened person there.
That's pretty big. That's hard on us as you use. Not be the smartest person in the room, but there it is. It happens.
Amen. I have so many things in my head. It's hard to focus on one. I think the society is a society of us and them, and if we choose that, then we're just on the wrong path because we're not better than them, they're not better than us, and the problem is fear and ignorance. I never thought in my life that I would be sitting across from a level 3 sex offender because those are not the kind of people that I might even be associated with, but that was my job. And I found that this person was a person too.
So I have 2 kids, a 7th grader and a 4th grader. And you think of the bigger issues. You know, you've been trying to talk to them about what's happening in the world. And they talk about their friends at school. So-and-so supports Trump. And we try to say, well, you know, that's probably what their parents are telling them and some other things. And one of my son's friends just got transferred schools because he was bullied for being short. And I'm like, see, even just these little things, like just being short, he was being bullied so much on the bus that his parents transferred schools. And one of the things I try to tell my kids is we go over the golden rule and how, you're using it backwards. Just because they did that to you doesn't mean you do it to them. You know, so I try to point that out every time it happens. And I also try to tell them, you know, if somebody says something really horrible that you can't, you know, just stop and go, wow, I can't believe you said that. And say it just like that. And either they might leave you alone or it might just give them enough pause that you have a moment to collect your, you know. So it's a hard road.
It's really hard.
What a talk. It leaves me with too many things to think about. But You know, I'm thinking of my brother who died several years ago, who I presume would be a Trump supporter today, and I've often thought if only I could talk to him, I could change his mind. But I'm thinking after what you said that that's perhaps not the approach I would like to take. And part of this comes up in an idea that I've had for years, that a fundamental part of anger is the absolute need to be right. And in discussions I have so often, I need to be right. And I think what you're talking about is maybe I need to have my views, but not have to be right.
I think that's exactly what spiritually intelligent people do. The list of what you have to do to be spiritually intelligent is really daunting, I have to tell you.
Okay, I thought of another example of what you were talking about, like the mother's socks and the monk's jacket, and that is the Gandhi story about when he was getting onto a train that was pulling out and he lost a shoe, and he immediately, without thinking, took the other shoe off and threw that with the other shoes. So that the poor man who found him would have a pair that he could use.
I think that humankind is hardwired into that us versus them, and what it needs, what needs to happen is that we work against it. I've been involved in several organizations all over the map. I was on a Klingon ship organization. We hated the Fed, the Federation, you know. And my boss is a Ducks fan, and she was talking the other day about how all Beaver fans are all rude. And I, you know, I said, all of them? She said, every single one. And I am celebrating 6 months sobriety. And I would have brought up pennies, but I didn't know there was change. And when I knew there was change, at that point people kept saying, well, keep the change. And I didn't think it was appropriate for me to tell her to give me 96 cents back. In AA, what they teach, and this is very interesting when you gave us that challenge, is when you're looking for a sponsor, and a sponsor is simply somebody who guides you through the 12 steps. That's their only responsibility. When you're looking for a sponsor, find one that you hate. Find a person that just makes you angry or makes you upset, or because in doing that, when you're pursuing only one goal, which is not to have a drink, all of a sudden the rest melts away, you know? And the common bond comes, and I think that is a good way to work against the us versus them.
I wanted to say something about the hardwiring of us versus them. So all of the major world faiths right now came about in the Axial Age, which was maybe 8,000 BC to, I don't know, maybe not that far back, maybe 5,000 BC to about zero. And that was when we started developing cities and city-states, and people were coming in contact with strangers. It wasn't so much just our little tribe and everything. And that's when they all sort of came into being, and all have this practice of hospitality to the stranger is huge. So I think those faiths, one of the impetus of all those faiths was that changing environment and the need to fight it, to fight this us versus them that's so easy for us to do.
Thank you. It was a really provocative sermon. And one of the things that I keep thinking about is Carl Jung was a psychologist who basically spoke about the shadow, which is the repressed side of ourselves that we don't look at until it comes up to bite us in the butt. And he talked about the eruption of the shadow into society. And that's kind of what I'm seeing here, is that because, you know, because I have denied my own racism, sexism, whatever, you know, that's, I can't let it go underground. I've got to acknowledge it and try to learn from it and not act on it. And so I would admonish Unitarians to look at yourselves. Look at your racism. Look at your sexism. Look at all those parts of yourself, because, you know, repression is not a good thing. We can't pretend anymore.
I'm interested in the idea of how people came together in the cities, because that's where a bunch of the one side votes come from, and rural areas is where a bunch where the other side votes come from. If I mean, it's okay to talk about that. And I'm thinking it goes back before cities, though, because I think even in tribal days, people were curious about strangers, as long as there weren't huge numbers of them to be threatening. You got the last word. Years ago, I used to interview people on the air, and when I finished, they thought I was on their side because I asked questions. I wasn't trying to convince them. But over the years, I've tried to convince people. So I think I'll go back to finding out.
Thank you very much, Tracy.